Great. Hi, it's Brian Katsoulis from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C.
Hi, this is Mushadov Zedi. I'm a columnist and an analyst based in Islamabad.
Mushadov, it's great to talk with you once again. And what we're going to do for the next 45 minutes or so is delve into the complicated situation in Pakistan, a country that many Americans hear about in the news but don't follow as closely as they should. And what I thought we would do is start out, since you're in the country there, to give us a snapshot, a very brief snapshot of the current situation, both from a political and a security standpoint, but also if you could say something about, you know, the economic situation too, because you write pretty regularly and very forcefully. And we'd love to hear, you know, what the state of play is right now in Pakistan overall.
You know, one of the thanks, Brian. It's great to talk to you, and I hope that that I'll get to pick your brain during the conversation also about what's happening in Washington, D.C.
Sure.
Just to sort of, you know, you mentioned a brief snapshot. I guess the place to start off is wouldn't be politics or security for me. It really would be the economy. Maybe it's just, you know, the inner Clinton in at least part of me. But this is an economy which should be huge. A few years ago, it was listed among 13 economies that were going to be the next generation BRICS, you know, the BRICS plus plus. The BRICS being Brazil, Russia, India, China, and then there was a list of 13 countries, and Pakistan was one of them. Where we are right now, it looks more like a sub-Saharan African country. Now, the problem with Pakistan being a sub-Saharan African country is that it's a country of 180 million people. It's a country with a huge military. It's a country that is located at the border of Afghanistan, Iran, and India, not to mention China up north. And it's a country that isn't really comfortable with itself. So the fact that it has no money, the government in Pakistan has no money, the military really depends on injections of hardware and money from the United States. And so it's the, you know, the root and the core of the problems in Pakistan are economic. And those problems are accentuated and made more complex by a number of internal and external political problems and by what I referred to momentarily there, some complex identity issues in terms of its history and how it came about and how it relates to the rest of the world. But really the core of Pakistan's problems is economic, and many of the other problems would still exist even if Pakistan was a booming economy, but they would matter a lot less.
You know, Musharraf, one thing when you say that, and first, I mean, thanks on the background on the sheer size of Pakistan, because a lot of people here in America, I don't think, understand that just in terms of population, it's larger than Russia. And we hear a lot, obviously, about Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran, and these sorts of issues tend to dominate our headlines. But if you take Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iran, add them up in terms of just population, and you don't even get, you're not even close to how large Pakistan is. So I think there's a lack of appreciation for just, A, not only just the sheer size, but then I think what you're getting to is just the potential that exists there too, the untapped potential within Pakistan, because it strikes me when I go to the country, I know on my last visit, I was there in the midst of what the Obama administration called its first AFPAC strategy, and combining Pakistan with Afghanistan in that way, making it AFPAC, was deeply offensive to many Pakistanis, because they say, look, we got an educated population, we got a strong middle class, and there's a strong sense of frustration that just from an economic standpoint, there is so much untapped potential. And, you know, I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about how or why that is the case, you know, why it's been this way for years.
It's I mean, there's so many reasons. Just to reiterate the size issue, the size of the middle class, according to one estimate, and this is from a while back, so it might even be bigger, but the size of the middle class in Pakistan is about 30 million. So that's the size of all of Afghanistan or the size of all of Iraq. That's just the Pakistani middle class. In terms of urban Pakistan, there are anywhere between 60 and 70 million Pakistanis that live in cities. In terms of cell phone penetration, for example, close to 100 million cell phone subscriptions out there, between 95 and 100 million cell phone subscribers. So, you know, all these numbers, you know, suggest that this country should be doing a lot better than it is. If nothing else, it should be doing a lot better because in and of itself, it's a huge economy. So even if it wasn't related to other economies, the domestic demand should be enough to keep the country going. And the fact that the country is constantly in crisis mode fundamentally has to do with the country having developed a habit of living way above its means. Now, this is something Americans probably should be able to relate to in terms of, you know, running deficits and the government spending more money than it earns from taxation. Of course, the fundamental and key difference is that in one case you're talking about the United States, the most powerful country on the planet, been around the block, you know, knows how to handle itself, and the biggest economy in the world. So there's a lot of bankers and a lot of countries and a lot of creditors that are always willing to provide loans to the U.S. Pakistan has not been around for that long, is very unstable, is often run by the military. There's a bunch of security issues, international security issues in Pakistan. And so for Pakistan to get loans is much more difficult. So when Pakistan runs deficits, which it does constantly, because it has a massive military, and of course there's a corrupt political class, largely corrupt political class that obviously needs to keep spending a lot of money to keep bringing in those patronage votes, then you're basically left frequently holding the bill in your hand and asking around if anybody will cover you. And that's exactly where Pakistan finds itself today economically.
And why is that in terms of the government leadership and the political leadership in that country? And I think this is a very basic question that I think a lot of Americans want to know the answer to. Who actually runs Pakistan? And who's making the decisions not only on the economic front, you can start there, but then also the security questions, which we're going to be getting into as it relates to terrorism and Afghanistan and the other things that we hear in our news over here. But who's running the country?
I think in terms of the most important decisions, to use the model of the 1950s sort of, you know, American family, and I deliberately say 1950s, it's daddy. Daddy runs the show. Daddy sort of goes out, earns some money, comes home. Mom is standing in the doorway with the, you know, with a tray of cupcakes and, you know, sort of dinner, you know, pot roast in the oven. Daddy in Pakistan is the Pakistani military. So all the key decisions and the bulk of the financial decisions, the resource allocation decisions, are taken by the military. This means, crucially, that Pakistan's relationship with India, which is its biggest neighbor, Pakistan's relationship with Afghanistan, which is its most complex neighbor, Pakistan's relationship with China, which is its most comfortable relationship, all these relationships are determined by how the Pakistani military sees the world. And because of the...
So this Pakistan military, it's like what we talk about, the military-industrial complex here in this country, and President Eisenhower talked about it. It's a military-industrial complex that's on steroids, as you describe it, that it has control over the political decision-making. And what role does it play in some of the industries? Maybe you can describe some of that for us.
Well, I was going to say, my initial sort of, you know, impulse was to say that, you know, it's just the military complex because given its size, Pakistan doesn't have an industry, and it certainly doesn't have an industrial complex. The economy has gone from being an agriculture-based economy to continuing to have a lot of people employed in the agricultural sector, but constantly declining agricultural productivity. And in the interim, because of hot money, you know, because of a lot of injection of cash post 9/11, because a lot of Pakistanis send home money every year, significant amounts of money, nearing $10 billion a year last year, then there's a huge services sector that's emerged. And so Pakistan's cities are new centers of growth, but that growth isn't based on industry or manufacturing, it's based on consumption. In many ways, again, very similar to the U.S., but I mean, I guess the point I'm making is that, you know, Pakistan, one of the key economic problems Pakistan has is that it doesn't have manufacturing or industry. Even so, a lot of Pakistan's industrial sort of productivity has military participation. The military is a big economic player. So it's not just involved in deciding whether it's going to be belligerent vis-a-vis India or not. It's also, you know, it's got so much cash that it's involved in banking, in finance, in fertilizers, in foodstuffs, all kinds of industrial ventures that are run by the military and its subsidiaries.
So when the U.S. talks about increasing its aid to Pakistan, which is something it's doing again, as you saw over the weekend, and as we're seeing with Vice President Biden's visit, I'm not sure if he mentioned it yet, and we've tripled non-military assistance to Pakistan, what you're saying, in essence, is that some of these fundamentals really haven't changed 2 years in, that even if the instinct of the Kerry-Lugar legislation may have been right in terms of trying to boost the civilian government and the democratically elected government in Pakistan, that still the fundamental powers that be in Pakistan are the people in the military.
Absolutely. I'd actually go further. I'd say that despite the important sort of inclusion and insertion of the civilian aid, the non-military aid through this, what was originally, as you well know, was originally called the Biden-Lugar aid bill.
Yeah.
It's now called Kerry-Lugar. Even though that was really an attempt to change and to shift the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan from a relationship that was really focused on how the U.S. could leverage the Pakistani military to a relationship where the U.S. could help catalyze and stimulate Pakistani democracy and the Pakistani economy. But that hasn't really happened. And I think one of the fundamental reasons it hasn't happened is that in spite of the good intentions of the Obama administration, and in spite of, you know, a lot of work done by really people who are friends of Pakistan, people like Hillary Clinton, like Joseph Biden, like John Kerry, in spite of their efforts, fundamentally, the most important thing that the U.S. wants with respect to Pakistan, just in terms of reality, is a level of cooperation that enables and assists what the U.S. is doing in Afghanistan. And so because that continues to be the core sort of focus of the U.S. efforts vis-a-vis Pakistan, then the military's dominance, of course, hasn't changed. If anything, it's helped further entrench the dominance of the military in the big sort of ticket issues in Pakistani life.
Your point on the U.S. dependency on the leaders of Pakistan's security establishment is spot on, and I agree that Afghanistan is a number one issue, and unfortunately we look at the Pakistan challenges through the lens of Afghanistan, which I actually think we need to start looking at thinking about differently. A second thing I'd add is that the fact that the Mumbai attacks took place during the transition, and then also the attempted Times Square bombing, which had roots back in Pakistan, as well as other terror plots that were thwarted here in Obama's first 2 years. Those sorts of things actually create even stronger dependency on Pakistan's security establishment, but on the part of the United States. So for all of the best intentions, Vice President Biden has, and John Kerry and others, in terms of trying to make the civilian government, the democratically elected government in Pakistan, have a stronger voice in policy, given that our number one priority still is the Afghanistan war and understandably the terrorism issue. I think it's a hard policy to implement if, at the end of the day, we're not really going to press the leaders of Pakistan's security services to take on a more mature relationship with the civilian government, and the relations between the civilian and military government have been tenuous at best. You had an article in the last couple of months, though, that talk about how the Pakistani security services really has reasserted itself, and maybe you could talk about that over the last year or so, that in the strategic dialogue, you had leaders of the Pakistani security services playing a role. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
It's been an interesting sort of a transformation. One of the ways in which Pakistan has continued to be run by the military is by the military maintaining a very clear perception in the public domain that it's a clean institution, that corruption isn't a big problem, that the military leaders of this country, as and when they become generals, they're the ones that love this country, they're the ones that sacrifice, you know, blood and sweat for this country. And so in the face of sort of, you know, corrupt political governments, the military has always been able to swoop in and save Pakistan. That's the narrative or the story that the military needs to tell in order to continually manage all these big ticket questions in Pakistan. I think what's important to sort of know about Pakistan is that by the end of the Musharraf era in 2008, that story didn't exist anymore. And the reason that story got obliterated had to do with two things. One was the rise of domestic terrorism, the rise of, you know, the Al-Qaeda affiliates and the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, the TTP, the Pakistani version of the Taliban. Those two groups and their affiliates and what they were doing in Pakistan from 2006 onwards, you know, the country has been bleeding. So that was one reason that, you know, people...
And they've killed, by the way, they've killed thousands of Pakistanis, right? I mean, the one statistic that it surprised many people here was that in 2010 alone, more Pakistanis were killed by violence in their country than Afghans were killed in their country last year. Report by Civic, that group, which I know, I think you looked at their report.
Exactly. Well, since 2005 onwards, upwards of 30,000 is what some estimates, Indian estimates actually, suggest upwards of 30,000 Pakistanis have died in this conflict between terrorists and the Pakistani state. So I think one of the reasons why the military lost its sheen and lost its, you know, attraction as an effective institution was because obviously all this terrorism was happening and the military wasn't really able to stop it. The other important sort of dynamic was the conflict between General Musharraf, the military leader at the time and a good friend of President Bush, and the Chief Justice of Pakistan. And this was a sort of institutional collision in which, for the first time in Pakistani history, a civilian, a judge in this case, didn't just buckle when he came under the pressure of the military, mm-hmm. and he stood up to him. And that really created a movement which ended up being the undoing of the Musharraf regime. I think, that's the background to where, you know, Pakistan was on the 15th of March, you know, 2 years ago. Where it was, where Pakistanis had enough of the military, Pakistanis had come out on the street and they forced the government and the military to take back that same Chief Justice who stood up to the military. And then there's been a number of things that have happened that have helped put the military back in the saddle. The first thing was, of course, that the terrorists were beginning to overrun a part of the country that's known as a tourist haven. Think like Aspen, Colorado, or, you know, sort of Aspen, Colorado, but cheaper. So, you know, yeah. a lot of middle-class Pakistanis used to spend their summers in Sawat. People were familiar with Sawat. And when the terrorists started taking over Sawat, it became a public, you know, there was public outcry. And obviously the only institution in the country that was going to be able to push back against the terrorists was the military. So that was the first big step in the sort of rebranding of the military, again, as this clean, pristine, positive institution. A number of other things happened, including, you know, how Pakistan reacts and responds to drone strikes, how Pakistani outrage was kind of mobilized in response to the Kerry-Lugar bill's provisions related to, you know, checks and balances on this institutional balance between the military and the civilian government. But the net result of all this, of course, is that the head of the military, General Kiani, got a 3-year extension, which was unprecedented. And General Kiani is the one that runs important meetings both in Pakistan and in Washington, D.C., when he's talking to the United States. When Pakistan's talking to the United States, the most important voice in Pakistan is the voice of General Kiani. So, yeah, the military...
So General Kiani could actually outlast not only the civilian government in Pakistan, but if President Obama doesn't win a second term, he could outlast Obama and Karzai. Is that right? His term goes until what year?
Until 2013, if I'm not mistaken. And that...
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's another... Three years, and that's interesting. It's almost this, you know, this most important position, and they've clawed their way back from being wounded at the end of the Musharraf era to really having a strong say on the security policy. And then you were going to mention, maybe I interrupted, but also the floods in the response of the Pakistani security services to the floods that happened last summer, right?
There was a tremendous sort of response, really, by everybody in Pakistan. But again, while the political government kind of fudged it, you know, the president wasn't in the country. There was a couple of snafus by the prime minister. Meanwhile, General Kiani and the military at large, as they should be, were right in the thick of things, you know, saving lives and taking relief and emergency operations to where they needed to be. So absolutely, the floods was another important part of this, if you will, the sterilizing of the image of the Pakistani military.
Yeah. You mentioned the SWAT incident, the place that's like Aspen, and I remember I was in Pakistan at the time when, you know, there was this very hyperbolic, I think, portrayal of what was a serious situation. It was of what was going on about an hour outside of Islamabad. The one thing that I think was interesting about that was what happened before the military went in. And I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit not only about the political deal that was attempted by many of the political parties with the militant groups in SWAT. And I wonder if you see any parallels between the sorts of deals that the Musharraf government struck in North and South Waziristan, if there's any comparability. The reason I bring it up is because part of the debate here in Washington on Afghanistan and a little bit on Pakistan is like, how much can you actually have a political or power sharing deal? And I wonder what, you know, if you what your reflections were on those attempts to, before the security agencies really got involved, the political negotiations and the deal that was signed on SWAT beforehand, and why that didn't last.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there are two sort of very different situations. In the tribal areas of Pakistan, North and South Waziristan, as well as other tribal agencies is what we call them, but basically tribal units, administrative units, mm-hmm. tribal states, if you will. In those areas, the reason that anybody who is looking for someone to capture or kill in those areas would want to make a deal is because if you don't make a deal, then you're basically, if you're going in with tanks and guns, then you're basically declaring war on the local tribes. And the thing about these tribes and this part of the world, the tribal areas, is that nobody's ever won a war there. The home team uh-huh. always wins. In the tribal areas. And so the Pakistani military, having learned from British military history and from having been up close and personal in helping train a lot of these tribals during the Afghan war with the Soviets, you know, the Pakistani military wasn't too keen to take these guys on, so they signed them up to these deals, and the idea was that they would help flush out some of the non-Pakistanis there, a lot of the Uzbeks and the Arab terrorists that had been there for many years. That was the rationale for the deals during the Musharraf era. The deal in Sawat, which is not a tribal area, the deal in Sawat was slightly different because the terrorists or the militants or whatever, the insurgents, whatever term we use for them, these guys, unlike in the tribal areas, these guys were antagonists of the local population. They had some small pockets of support, but they didn't have real political popularity in the tribal in Swat. And the deal was really struck almost as a tactic by the government and the military to allow this group to maybe demonstrate how sincere it was in normalizing the situation in Swat. Of course, what ended up happening is that these guys, they signed the deal and then they kept doing what they were doing before, which created the opening for the government and the military to sort of mobilize a national narrative against it and then go in with the military into Swat.
Yeah, and if I recall properly, I think it was Sufi Muhammad when one of the leaders who had signed the deal, when he said some things about the Pakistani system of government, that elections were un-Islamic and that the court systems were un-Islamic, there was this huge reaction among many Pakistanis saying that's not right, you know, that's incorrect.
Yeah.
And that was part of the motivation there, where not only were they seen to not live up to their word in whatever deal was struck in Swat, they were also the leaders who had signed the agreement from the extremist group side were going against what many Pakistanis saw to be core principles that were at the foundational principles of their country. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And actually, what you've said actually points to a much larger sort of thing about Pakistan, a fact, a reality about Pakistan that really isn't captured in a lot of these kinds of discussions. But, you know, Pakistan came about not because of a violent jihad. You know, it came about because of a political and legal process. The founder of this country was one of the finest lawyers in British India. You know, there were a series of elections that produced the Muslim League, which was the sort of founding party for, it was called the All India Muslim League at the time, but it was a democratic and legal process that helped secure what is known as Pakistan today. So freedom for Pakistan was really a political and a legal process and not an armed war or, you know, wasn't something that Pakistan was won by force. I think that is deeply embedded within the Pakistani DNA, both politically and otherwise. And so even when you have military dictators in this country, it's an odd kind of a country to have this kind of a military-civilian relationship, because every military dictator that comes in, within a few days of taking over power, the first thing he says is he's taken over to save democracy. And the second thing he does is that he announces a date that on such and such day, I'm going to have an election. The elections usually are shams, but the point is that no military dictator feels he can survive in Pakistan without at least giving the impression that he is committed to listening to the will of the people. So the will of the people is actually quite a fundamental article of faith in Pakistani society and in the history of Pakistani politics. I know, Brian, that you've been writing a little bit about this issue of democracy and governance, and I think it links up well to this tradition that I was talking about in Pakistan, this history of a commitment to democracy within the broader society. Tell me a little bit about what the administration is doing now, because I know that you said that there's been a, you know, in one of your recent pieces, you talked about there's been a deficit in terms of how much effort the Obama administration has put in to the strengthening of democracy and governance in Pakistan.
Yeah. Well, first I would say, compared to the previous administration, the Bush administration, I think the Obama administration has done a hell of a lot more when it comes to trying to help Pakistanis strengthen other centers of power. So to not exclusively become dependent on one singular leader. I think there's been a very genuine attempt to do many different things to help Pakistanis solidify a more democratic system. I don't think we've done nearly enough for many of the reasons that we talked about before, because of our concerns, America's concerns, ultimate concerns about terrorism and the Afghan war, and our dependency on the Pakistani security establishment. The one thing, despite all of its stated intent to try to boost the democratic government and the civilian government in Pakistan, I don't think the Obama administration has done nearly enough here, in part because it's a very hard thing to do. The Kerry-Lugar legislation tried to put more of an emphasis on this in highlighting non-military assistance. And we initiated a strategic dialogue that involves many different aspects of the Pakistani government, not just the security, but wide-ranging on economic development, on agriculture, and other things. My concern, though, is that all of these attempts to try to broaden the portfolio, if you will, of contacts that we have still remain incomplete and still feed into a system that is still ultimately dysfunctional and operates with a political elite that is still largely disconnected from their own population. So, you know, a couple of things I would say is that although I think this administration has done a much better job compared to Bush, that we're trying to build relations with a broader range of not only leaders, but also reach out to Pakistanis through this strategic dialogue. More could be done to ensure bodies like the parliament and the Pakistani government actually have more of a meaningful say in terms of budget priorities, oversight over a full range of executive agencies. And to this day, we don't have that. Another part of the problem, I think, with what we're doing, why it remains incomplete, is because of our lens of the Afghanistan war, that we're not looking at the full range of potential within Pakistan and reaching outside of the bubble, but that we're still, you know, every few weeks sending Admiral Mullen or somebody from our intelligence agencies to work with your intelligence agencies, and that's the number one priority. So I think it's still, you know, steps in the right direction, but still horribly incomplete. And then it looks like, the last thing I'd say, we're about to shovel more cash into the system without demanding greater transparent democratic accountability within the system. And I think that could potentially yield more corruption.
Yeah. I mean, look, one of the sort of arguments that I make whenever there's a visiting delegation, whenever we're talking to people in the U.S. government, is that really, and I wrote about this almost immediately after Obama announced Leon Panetta as the CIA director. Of course, Panetta has a great history of being one of the great sort of public policy gurus in the Democratic Party and someone whose career sort of I followed since before the Clinton administration. And I wrote a piece in which I said, look, you send us the CIA director, you send us the, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you send us the NSA, but, you know, the head of the ACLU doesn't come with any of these people. The head of the United Way, the March of Dimes, the NAACP, the ACLU, the, you know, the NCAA, you know, university sports. Even if you look at, you know, Pakistani students enrolled in U.S. universities, that number is one of the only countries in the world, and this is including Saudi Arabia and other countries, so it can't be the excuse that, you know, there's a security factor. But it's one of the only countries in the world that has consistently gone down in terms of the number of Pakistani students enrolled in American universities. And so it's these non-state sort of interactions. I mean, university students is a great example of how you construct a long-term narrative where you create, you know, a population of people that has interests in both countries and that can be a lubricant for better relations between these two societies, different societies, but societies that also share many of the many problems.
Absolutely, and I completely agree with that. And although there are some initiatives and there are academic exchanges and Fulbright scholars and Humphrey scholars come from Pakistan to this country, it's not nearly enough. And for anyone who's watching this dialogue on the internet in Pakistan, we welcome, I'm at an independent think tank, a research institute, we welcome a range of Pakistanis here for conversations. And we often do have young political leaders coming in or young business leaders from Pakistan on their own initiative, just to have an exchange of ideas. I've been involved with various dialogues, one through the U.S. Muslim Engagement Initiative, that seeks to broaden this. And I think that's, you know, I think part of the thing that is hampering the Obama administration's attempts to really get out of this box of a transactional, tactical relationship with Pakistan is that it's still doing it with the instruments of power that have always run U.S. national security. And even if, you know, we successfully tripled non-military assistance to Pakistan, I think Pakistanis should understand that the parts of the U.S. government, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the State Department, the ones that are supposed to be helping implement these programs, they're very slow to move, in large part because they're government agencies. You know, they can't move as quickly as the organizations that you listed, Musharraf. The private sector, the academic institutions, and others can and should do more. I think America's best bilateral cooperations around the world since, you know, World War II, it wasn't just about government to government or certainly military to military. It was with many European countries in that post-World War II era, deepening our ties, you know, outside of the government. And the last thing I'd say is that, you know, I have many friends who went into the Obama administration and are serving. We just lost about 70 people, 7-0, from the Center for American Progress who went into the White House and other places. And the thing that strikes me the most when I talk to these people who go into government, as powerful as the U.S. government is, it's very limited in its ability to do so many things that I think can address a lot of the problems that you were starting out to talk about at the top, the economic issues and the social problems and the debates about the role of religion in society. Those sorts of things, it's just not, it's not appropriate. I mean, it's not helpful, I think, sometimes to have government or politicians to talk about this. We need religious leaders and others to exchange these ideas through more civil society forums.
Absolutely, and this is exactly the point. I mean, you know, people have been talking about the parallels between the brutal assassination of Salman Taseer, the governor of Punjab, which is the biggest province in this country. 90 million people live in that province. Now, the governor isn't the same as in the U.S. because governors here are nominated by the federal government. We have chief ministers who are the equivalent of governors. But the point is, very senior guy, very, you know, famous man, powerful man, shot down because of, you know, a religious fanatic, you know, who didn't like some of the things that he said about Pakistan's blasphemy law. Many people were, you know, drawing parallels between that and the shooting in Arizona where six people died and where the congresswoman is still, I think, in critical condition, if I'm not mistaken. I've actually argued that those parallels have severe limitations. But the point is that there are conversations that Americans and Pakistanis can be engaged in that are not adversarial, but that actually try and deal with a range of issues that are common. And the one thing that we haven't talked about, I think you just alluded to it, but it's also simply, you know, where's the conversation between small Pakistani entrepreneurs and big American businesses in terms of investing in Pakistan, in terms of seeing Pakistan as a marketplace for American products and services, and in terms of seeing Pakistan as a place where, you know, things can be made to sell in the United States. So there's a whole economic dimension to this. And again, I know that the administration is doing a little bit, and there's Exim Bank, and there's all kinds of other, you know, small initiatives. But really, until there's a more robust people-to-people interaction, until more Americans aren't landing at Pakistani airports, just, and, you know, engaging with ordinary Pakistanis, with businessmen, with students, with leaders, with activists, I think, you know, we'll continue, these two countries will continue to have this very complicated transactional relationship in which it's very easy for one country to feel that it's constantly being used in a rather undignified way by the other country, which is really where we are today.
And you pointed this out in one of your articles when President Obama in November visited India, right next door to Pakistan, and the deep sort of ties that the U.S. has with Indian businesses, and it's a feature of our economy. It's in our consciousness here, and you have the Indian American community playing a very active role in our not only our business but our politics. And there's great potential for Pakistani Americans to do this, and I think that's a big part of addressing not only the challenges within Pakistan but addressing the bilateral relationships. I think one thing I want to circle back to, though, before we forget about it, is just the security question, because it does continue to dominate. I think if you talk to most American CEOs as to what's the main thing that prevents them from going to Karachi or going to Lahore and trying to build partnerships, and I think it all comes back down to security. and the stability within the country. And that's just one thing that this is still an emergency crisis with the tens of thousands of people having been killed inside the country. I don't think it's been adequately addressed yet in our conversation. I mean, what do you think, sitting there in Pakistan, would be the most effective steps to address this internal security challenge? Because I think you can't have one without the other. And I'm not suggesting a full sequencing here, but you need greater stability, I think, to attract more foreign investment. And what are the things that aren't being done right now to help bring greater stability to Pakistan?
You know, that's a much bigger question than maybe I can, address. I mean, obviously, there are two kinds of security challenges to Pakistan. One is the security challenge that directly affects Pakistan. So you have a group like the TTP, which directly affects Pakistan, which attacks Pakistani soldiers and cops, and which basically has declared war on Pakistan. But you also have a second category of sort of violent extremists who are not at war with Pakistan, but who may have declared war on other countries. And so I'm talking specifically about groups like the LET, which, you know, essentially is at war with India, and other groups with more global aspirations, or groups that are affiliated with Al-Qaeda, groups that didn't exist 3 years ago, but, you know, sort of copycat groups. So I think there's two categories of security challenges. And I think one of the ways in which, you know, folks in Pakistan who understand these things have tried to articulate to the Pakistani establishment, to Pakistani power brokers, is that whereas in one case there's a direct challenge to Pakistani security, in the second case there's an indirect challenge. Because, of course, whatever these groups were threatening other countries do, if those countries get really upset and react, then their response will directly challenge Pakistani security as well. So whether it's direct or indirect, Pakistan needs a medium to long-term strategy as to how it's going to uproot these groups, remove and terminate the irreconcilables, who are probably, you know, a very small number.
For all of you blogging heads viewers who are watching this, and however we splice this, this is the perils of doing conversations across the world, and sometimes, you know, with unreliable phone systems. But you were talking about the internal threats and how to deal with them, and we can pick up from there.
Yeah. So I was basically saying that, you know, there's internal threats, but even these indirect threats, that is a group that, you know, attacks a second country, and then that second country says, well, you know what, we're coming after them, even though, you know, your country's not sponsoring this, but those groups are in your country. So I think, you know, basically Pakistan's calculus on violent extremists has to be that none of them are acceptable. But the way that that calculus would be executed, or the manifestation of that changed thinking, shouldn't be and couldn't be something immediate. I mean, if people want to see the dismantling of the LET, for example, that's not something that can happen overnight. That's something that would take anywhere from a decade and longer, because, of course, some of these groups have very deep roots in society. Many of these groups have promoted and perpetuated a narrative which is attractive to the Pakistani people. Many of them have deep welfare pockets. You know, they help out at times of catastrophe like earthquakes and floods. They have big relief operations and, you know, humanitarian operations. And so there's a certain way in which Pakistan has to begin to strategize and think about, you know, how it's going to tackle this problem long term. Now, in the meantime, I think that part of the problem in terms of, you know, big CEOs coming and visiting Pakistan is more a problem of how Pakistan is talked about in Washington, D.C., on the front pages of the New York Times, in the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. And I think that this is where sort of the trust deficit, which is an overused term between Washington and Islamabad, but which is a real problem, because I think there's not just a trust deficit between two governments. Unfortunately, fundamentally, I think there's a trust deficit between two peoples. The fact that so many different leaks and so many different reports from here that suggest to the American people, for example, that the Pakistani military isn't sincere in helping out the Americans in Afghanistan, and in fact may directly be aiding and abetting the insurgents in Afghanistan, that can't possibly create a good feeling, in American hearts and minds. And so the reciprocal is that when you see bad news from Pakistan, it isn't so much, hey, that's really bad, and maybe we should go and help out and, set up industries and do trade with them. I think the response is more like, oh, hell, those guys are getting what they deserve. So I think this is why I was emphasizing the need for more people-to-people interaction, because whatever the governments may do, and, different governments will have different approaches to this, but fundamentally, the American and the Pakistani people need to recognize each other's humanity and the common and shared interests and the common and shared problems that both countries face.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I completely agree. I also think it's easier said than done. Given the context here in the United States, I mean, one example of sort of the dynamic you describe here is you just look at the relative reaction to the Haiti earthquake, which is a year ago today, by the U.S. public versus the relative inaction to the Pakistani floods. Our people in the U.S. government have done a lot, but there really haven't been the sort of telethons that we had for Haiti and other things. And I think a big part of it is not only what people say about whatever double dealing or aiding and abetting of terrorist groups may be happening, but when you have headlines like you did the day after the Times Square bombing attempt that had the picture of Shahzad on the front page of many newspapers, one headline said, "Made in Pakistan."
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's what's top of mind, if anything at all.
Yeah.
And as you and I know, I mean, it's your country, and I've been there quite a lot. There's a much richer and deeper tradition, and Pakistan should not be represented by these most extremist, radical voices in any way, much in the same way that America should not be represented by this horrific murderer who tried to kill the congresswoman last weekend. These people are outliers, and we need, to place these challenges on a much more solid foundation than we do have right now. And I, you asked me before, I think Obama's doing a much better job than before when we were just dealing with the inter-services intelligence and the military. He's trying to broaden the relationship, but governments can only do so much, and governments are going to be ultimately limited in the long run. One last thing I want to talk about, and I think I'm glad we talked about it in this focus. And, if you have any more questions, but I know we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon. I don't know if you have anything else in terms of the Pakistani perspective about questions that you have about how D.C. does things or how it's looking at the situation.
Well, obviously, a lot of the narrative in Pakistan, which I'm sure you've heard about, and which many people in the U.S. have heard about, is this constant, anti-Americanism that exists here. And before I ask you to sort of, explain how that's seen in D.C., I think it's important to also contextualize it. And the way to contextualize it, I think the best way to understand it is that, of course, this is a country where the American embassy is over flooded with applications for immigration, with applications for asylum, with applications for, student visas and visit visas and business visas. So it's interesting that the same country that produces these long lines of people that, are seeking the American dream also produces this kind of rabid sort of anti-Americanism. And I think part of it has to be understood from what, sort of the mirror reflection on the other side. Is that if the average American sees a picture of Faisal Shahzad, this fellow who was behind the Times Square plot in May, I think it was, in 2010, the sort of opposite representation here is a drone strike. These sort of birds in the sky dropping missiles on, supposedly people who, aren't expecting it, and maybe, many civilian casualties who aren't really involved in the war getting in the middle of this crossfire. I think drones and many other sort of similar things that have happened repeatedly over a period of time have hardened hearts and minds here. And so I think that just like, and I think it's unfair because, of course, that only represents one aspect of American power. How is anti-Americanism being seen in D.C. and what are the sort of potential responses to it?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and I think we'll have even more of a focus on this. But over the last year, year and a half, I would say here, just working in D.C., traveling out around the world quite frequently, the thing that's changed between, you know, say, the heart of the Bush years in 2006 and now is that national security, all of the issues, whether it's the war in Afghanistan or Iraq or the challenges in Pakistan, national security just does not animate our national discussion as much. So, you know, I think there's still serious concerns about the anti-Americanism, and people understand that changing how we're viewed around the world is important. And in fact, there were polls in the 2008 election, just general public opinion polls, which surprised me, that said many Americans were concerned about how we were viewed around the world. And I think it was one factor of many that led to the change and the shift away from Bush. But the one thing I think people need to understand also is that national security is not, you know, there's only a smaller, very small slice of Americans who really follow these issues intensely and are really, you know, concerned about the anti-Americanism. It's a concern among policy elites, among the political faction. It's certainly, President Obama made sort of the reset of America's image around the world a key priority. I'm not certain that looking back on the last 2 years, many Americans care as much as they did before. And that's a function of, I think, our own internal problems, the economic difficulties, and just a general concern. You know, we moved from sort of shock after the 9/11 attacks to anger, and then we acted in ways that I think undermined our own security and maybe didn't help our position in the world. And now I think most ordinary Americans are a little baffled as to, you know, why is that? Why are people still kind of against us? And why do they hate us? And I think the main point, though, it's less dominant in our psyche right now. And I think it's in part because the wounds from the attacks of 9/11 and other things have faded quite a lot. And also a fact that we just simply don't, we're a nation still with hundreds of thousands of troops in combat, but we really don't debate it in the way that we did, say, back in 2006 or 2007.
Yeah, no, that's clear. As a matter of fact, I think often when I try to think about, you know, this relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan, it almost seems like Pakistan is like the first great, you know, definitive test of a new era of American power, you know, where American power was able to achieve many things, you know, over the last 50 or 60 years, not always through being engaged in a war, but often through the threat of war, sometimes actually being actively engaged as well. But Pakistan represents, you know, a wholly new sort of kind of a challenge. And I think in this new world where unilateralism is constrained by many factors, one of them being, you know, the American economy itself, I'm not sure that, you know, the combination of diplomatic sort of power and development assistance and military might, I'm not sure if those three things alone are sufficient. And this is why, you know, increasingly, just as, you know, in other aspects of life, there's a greater emphasis on civil society and on the private sector. I think even in terms of the projection of American power and the achievement of, you know, strategic American objectives, you know, it's going to be civil society and the private sector in many ways that are going to be at the forefront of that. But of course, as you said,
I completely agree. I mean, I wrote a piece in last month that talked about open source power, the nature, you know, just like open source code, yeah. You have so many different actors that can play in it. And what's interesting is that in our think tanks here, and I'm deeply engaged in a lot of these debates, we're like debating like the narrowest of narrow slices. You know, one of the biggest things that's been in vogue recently has been counterinsurgency tactics, which, you know, I've been critical of, in part because, look, I think at its core, it makes sense. It's like, you know, you try to make people feel protected in their communities and make their lives better. But it's such a narrow slice, and it's so focused on what you know, boots on the ground can do, when we see, and you see in Pakistan, I see in my own country here, that there are other forces, religious leaders, civil society leaders, that matter much more in shaping how people understand the problems they see in their own lives.
Yeah.
And it's really incomplete to address these security challenges. And that's why, you know, you've written about this. When I was reading some of your articles and thinking about some of the things I wrote a book called The Prosperity Agenda in 2008, and it was aimed at trying to help people understand that global security issues in Pakistan or security issues for Americans, are still, much of our policy elite debates are still trapped in the 20th century mindset, and that we need to, you know, think in new ways about new centers of power, the ones that you're talking about, you know, civil society and others, and marshal them, because that's what I think is mostly been incomplete about the Obama approach to Pakistan. It's this ultimate test of what they call smart power, but what they define as smart power are those things that are simply just diplomacy and development and the military, and that's, I think, necessarily incomplete.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more, and I think that, you know, one of the, I guess it rounds back to the issue of this military-industrial complex that you mentioned, which is, of course, an important and in some ways dominant power even in the U.S. But, you know, just today I was discussing, you know, on a television interview here in Islamabad on the economic front why Pakistan needs F-16s. And, of course, the reason Pakistan is buying F-16s is because, you know, each F-16 off the, you know, off the assembly line in the U.S. helps create jobs there, and each F-16 that comes here helps, you know, strengthen a number of, you know, economic interests within the Pakistani military here. And yet, like you said, this is, you know, an F-16 is a symbol of a 20th century mindset, especially in Pakistan, you know, a country that has nuclear weapons and a country that really is not engaged in aerial warfare with terrorists. It's engaged in, you know, in some cases, guerrilla warfare. So just this point about the F-16s is that, you know, the F-16s is a 20th century way of thinking about national security. And again, it's about, you know, helping a conversation that moves Pakistan itself, in and of itself, as well as in terms of its relationship with other countries like the U.S., helping it move into the 21st century and to think more creatively about how, you know, the focus of public funds in this country should be on, you know, human capital and social capital rather than, you know, the physical capital of war, which, you know, an F-16 represents. Of course, you know, one of the reasons for the insecurity that drives this interest in F-16s, even if the people involved might be, you know, benefiting from it economically, it's feeding into a larger narrative, which is quite potent, which is, of course, the insecurity of being Pakistan. And that's not an illegitimate, you know, insecurity. That's a very legitimate fear. It's a fear that's based on 63 years of, you know, repeated conflict, constant conflict with at least one of its neighbors, with India, you know, three, maybe four wars, depending on how you define Gargil, in 1998. It's got a very tense relationship with Iran. It's got a very complicated and problematic relationship with Afghanistan. And so from all sides, Pakistan is a country where the armed forces have always felt that it's always on the brink of national security disaster. And part of this fear was sort of realized when Pakistan broke into two countries in 1971, Bangladesh, you know, and Pakistan. Ultimately, without addressing these insecurities, and this is, of course, the big question about Pakistan is how those insecurities will get addressed. But unless Pakistanis themselves aren't able to address these insecurities internally, and unless the international community isn't able to give Pakistan some sense of security vis-a-vis India in particular, this behavior, almost schizophrenic behavior, where it wants to be a modern country, it wants to be an economic power, but it also wants to be stuck in the 20th century and you know, the Cold War way of doing things, this is going to continue. And so I hope that, you know, in Washington, D.C., Brian is helping other folks think about how creatively that sort of a transformation might be achieved. Brian?
Yeah, and I hope you're, I mean, I think you're doing that in your writings there in Pakistan. And I think, you know, my hope for dialogues like this is that we can do more of these. And in fact, you know, and changing this sort of 20th century mindset and on national security here in this country, I mean, it strikes me that I'm often bored by discussions on security here because it is often fought on like the narrowest sets of issues, whether we're going to increase troop levels by 5 or 10% in a particular country really consumes our media in a certain way. And what you're talking about and what we've been talking about here, I think, is trying to explore a full range of different centers of power that exist in your country and mine and around the world. And I hope, you know, I think to sum up in conclusion, I think this has been a very rich discussion. I think you've provided a really clear snapshot of the complex security challenges in Pakistan. We talked a little bit about the Obama administration's attempt to deal with them, but it's all necessarily incomplete. And it's my hope that we can continue this discussion to try to grapple with these issues.
I look forward to that, Brian. It was great to talk to you again.
Okay. Stay safe out there and we'll be in touch.
Take care of yourself. Goodbye.
All right. Take care.
Bye.